Yeah. I still do some things that's off the easy way, like sitting on this stool. If I stand up sometime, my leg goes to sleep. I'm not walking, but I'm bumming. I'm an alcoholic. And every time I get up behind the podium, same thing happened to me just about every time that I spoke, you know. I get sweaty hands, and my dentures get loose. I really need to go to the bathroom today. I don't know what to do, but I just went before I got up here. But when you get my age, you got to remember the last time you went. So it's a pleasure being up here. This is the first time I've been to this building, but we used to come to meetings before this place was rebuilt. I came to a lot of meetings up here when I had it in the basement, and there was a lot of sobriety around then, a lot of good old-timers around it. It taught me some few things about life that I didn't know anything about. All I knew about was drinking and hurting people's feelings and ruining lives when I got to AA. Anyway, I was born a while back, you know, and I was born and raised in Culpeper County, and I grew up with a mean, drunken daddy, I'd like to put it like that. I don't know if he's alcoholic. He drank on weekends, but he didn't touch a drop during the week. And he never opened his mouth during the week either. He never spoke or talked to us. The word love was never mentioned in my family. And on weekends, I was the youngest of four children. I had an older brother and two older sisters. And I remember many a night, on Fridays, my mother would put me underneath the bed sometimes. And I would stay there sometime till Sunday. I didn't eat underneath there because my daddy was in a rampage beating my mother, and I knew he was going to kill her. And that's where I grew up. And I grew up hating my daddy. And I swore I'd never be like him. And I wasn't. I was 10 times his dad, probably, I think. But that's where I grew up. So I grew up with two things against me. One of them was fear and one of them was shame. I was scared to death and I was ashamed. I was made to wear hand-me-down clothes. They were clean, but they had patches on them. I remember going to school 6, 7, 8 years old with patches all over me, and I was ashamed of that. And also, I was ashamed to come out of my house. We lived between a lawyer on one side of me and the banker on the other side, and I was scared to come out of the house on Monday to go to school. Even when I began to realize, 7, 8 years old, about my daddy's drunkenness. And I was ashamed to come out and go to school on Monday morning. So that was a crutch that I used for a long time. But I got in a lot of trouble in school. After I started, I guess the first drink I took, I don't know how old I was, but my daddy always had parties on weekends, and he shot crap and had some drunks running around there. And my mother used to run them off a baseball bat sometimes. And I'm telling you, that we used to have, and it's always, the law was always there locking somebody up on weekends at my house. And that was, I was ashamed of that, you know. And I saw a lot of commotion stuff going on, and I used to go crawl around and sneak behind these guys that were shooting crap and all and drink the beer, you know, at some early age. And cigar butts and ashes and all right on down. I was drinking right on down, but I was drinking beer early. But by the time I got probably 11 years old, 12 years old, I was drinking beer pretty regular. And I love what it did to me. I remember the first time I really got high on it. I had a paper route in Culpeper, and I delivered papers on Sunday morning in the wintertime. It was cold as devil one Sunday morning, and my buddy and I, his name was Lawrence Level. He's dead now, but we used to meet at the medical arts building in Culpeper, a big building. I used to be a doctor, we'd get warm. And one morning, we met there, and I went in there, and he was sitting on his desk, and I said, Lawrence, you never guess what I found over in old Jack Bench's, not Jack Bench, Jack Lewis's yard. He said, what is that? I said, a pint of liquor. He said, well, go get it, and we'll have a little taste and warm up. So I went and got it, brought it in there, and it was full pint, and we cut the heads off. He took a little shot, and I took a little. I guess we drank that much of it. That was about all the whole pint. But I felt it. I felt it so much. I tell you what I did. I went and got the rest of my papers. I had my sister's bike because I couldn't afford mine yet. And it was a girl's bike. She had a basket on it. And it took me 3 trips. They used to drop my papers off at the theater down Main Street. So I went there and got them. made three loaves and took them down to Mount Run, dumped them over in Mount Run. And that started, you know, I didn't work for nobody after I had a drink. And that really started going downhill after that. And I got a lot of trouble for that. And on the way home, that morning was still pitch dark, cold. I was going down the main street, and I was looking down at the white lines, how fast I fell in that thing, looking how fast I was going. And I hit a 49 Buick. Had a slant bite on it, and I went off like a rocket. And the bike stayed there. I got gravel all in my nose, my face, my knees, and I had to pick that bike up and carry it home, those three or four blocks. And I knew my sister was going to beat my ass. So when she woke up, my older sister caught me and my youngest to give me a good ass whipping. So the first time I drank, I got in trouble, alcohol, but I used to think I'd have blamed it on that. No way, but my drinking kind of went downhill after that. But in school, we got in a lot of problems drinking. We used to pool our money. The lunches were 20 cents back in when I was in school, and we would take four or five of us. One of us off to five or six would have a car. That was, you know, nobody else couldn't afford too many. And we would pool our money and go. You could get a six-pack of Old Yingling, Old German for 59 cents, I believe it was. We'd go out to Tappel, and the guy would sell it to us out there. And we would drink that for at lunch. We didn't eat anything and go back to school. And three or four times we got caught. They could smell it on us, and we got expended. 3 days all at Centennial, and we loved that, so we just did it just to get out of school. But I always passed. It seemed like I passed. But anyway, after school, I was drafted in the Army as soon as I got out of school, and I went overseas, and of course that's a place, if you don't know how to drink, they'll teach you. And God, I fell in love with all the beer, the five-star beer there, and the cognac, and I got to, I was going AWOL more than I was putting time in, and I got in a lot of trouble. I couldn't keep a stripe. Every time I'd get one, I'd go AWOL, and they'd come in and tear that off. So I think I was the only man I know of that come out low when I went in, if that's possible. But when I got out, I moved out in Illinois with my sister. My youngest sister lived out there, and I went out there and brother-in-law and worked out there for about a year in Kankakee, Illinois, and it was just a great place to drink. Just like being overseas, a beer joint on every corner there, and they had a couple of places we used to go on weekends, and they played music there, and I played a guitar and sang a little bit, and I got fooling around out there at the end of the weekend. We was on TV out there, and stayed drunk and just thought I was having a ball, and I stayed out there about a year. But when I came back to Virginia, I met my wife, and we were married in 1958, and I was drunk then, and I was drunk the next 35 years, to be honest with you. I just could not get sober, save my neck. I was wild. We had, at least she did, she had four kids, and I don't even remember most of them being born. I was wild. I couldn't settle down. I don't have to tell, most of you know what that stuff does. I got sold that nothing meant anything to me. I had what a lot of people dream of. I've had good jobs. I had wife, kids, you know, things that, pretty good place to live. And I just didn't care about it. It meant nothing to me, the drink. I was alcoholic from the time I was born, I believe. And I always tell people that when that doctor held me up that morning when I was born and spanked my ass, I never got over it. I stayed pissed off and mad the rest of my life till I got the AA. And I stayed mad in here for 10 years, angry at everybody. And I wasn't happy. I wasn't drinking, but I was a time bomb, I guess. And but anyway, I tried my best to get my wife to drink. We were married 12 years, and I was getting in trouble. Half time we wasn't speaking. Wasn't sleeping in the same room or house half the time. And I just had to do something to get her off my back, so I tried to get her to take a drink, and she never would take one. I tried for 12 years. If I could get her drunk, she wouldn't know what I'm doing. That's what I wanted to get her drunk for. And one day she took a drink, and she bloomed in the overnight, blooming alcoholic. Well, you can imagine what two alcoholics, practicing alcoholics, and four kids in there. I don't have to tell you some of the things that happened in that household. Some of you probably know, but I'm not proud of anything, but it's part of it. My wife, the only way she got so sick from it that she had to go in a treatment center after 12 years of drinking. And I'm in a place called Primavera. They put her in there, and they said they're just trying to keep her alive. They wasn't worried about keeping her from drinking, but she was just about dead. And of course, I didn't know this, you know. And I had four kids coming along. The oldest ones were already into booze. I didn't know it. I was too busy drunk myself. I didn't know what the kids needed and what they didn't know. But anyway, she was in that treatment center, and she finally got out of there, and she got sober. About a year and a half, she was sober. And we had moved down on the Rappahannock River. I moved down there for one reason. Y'all probably can figure that out, you know. Nobody around me. I lived down on 300 acres that I rented, and I could pee off the back porch. Not a soul could see me. So I loved it down. I could drink and go down to the river and take my baths and just loved it. I didn't know that the kids and the wife just hated it. Didn't know that till I got sober, really. But anyway, one day I sobered up a little bit. I hadn't remembered the last time I saw my wife. And somebody said, well, somebody's been coming down here getting a couple of guys and taking in town to this sex club that she done joined or something. I said, my God, I better check on that, you know. So I found out a guy named Bill Jay. He was coming down there picking up and taking her to this sex club meeting there and caught up on Main Street. And I said, they don't know who they fooling with. So I got my bottle and my gun and my spy glasses, and I went over there to that meeting one night, and I sat behind the 7-Eleven over on Main Street, and I watched her. And she went up the steps, had four steps going up out to the hotel. They used to have a speakers meeting over every Wednesday. And I watched her come up the neck, and four men standing there, and every damn one of them hugged her when she went up the steps. I said, I got the goods on her, so I sat there, and I took a few more drinks, and after an hour, they all come out, and every man in there hugged her. I said, I know what's going on. But a good-looking thing like me at home, and she got to run around out there and find, anyway, I'm going to show them. So I went and got me 7 sticks of dynamite. It's the God's truth. And I said, I'm going to show them. I'm going to blow that damn meeting up. I'm going to fix them. They don't know who they're fooling with. So I'd go to a Wednesday night with my bottle, and I'd look at it and watch it, and I'd say, great day. So the night I decided to blow up, I got my dynamite, and I was getting out the truck. Now, I don't know if I'd have done it. I believe I was crazy enough to do it. That's the way I was thinking. And I happened to look at this fella done parked the car, and I looked over, and it was Earl the Barber. And he walked across the street, and he went up and down. I said, well, that fucker messed around with my wife. I said, but I don't want to blow Earl up. I drank with Earl. That's the last that thought, and it left. So I put the dynamite back in the trunk of my car. But when I got to AA, I carried that dynamite around almost 3 years. Finally, I don't remember what I did, but I gave it to somebody. But that's kind of the way I was thinking when I got into AA. But before that happened, my wife and I had, she was sober a year and a half. And we were going to the races a lot over Charlestown, and we loved the race. And she did too, and we'd go over there. But one night we went over with another couple, and we were coming back. And we always stopped and made breakfast, and Big Shot me, you know, we went in this place, and I ordered a beer, a mug of beer, and the woman brought four glasses. And I said, you take one of them glasses back. She can't drink, pointing my finger at her. You don't tell a damn alcoholic he can't drink, at least not her anyway. And she said, I'll show you. And the woman set the pitcher of beer down, she grabbed the whole pitcher and started chugging it. So she killed her a year and a half. She was a miserable inmate, trying to live with me. I knew that. I don't know that now. I didn't know it then, but anyway, she had to go back in treatment, and she got sober again, and she had left me, and there wasn't any kids left down there but me on the Rappahannock River, and I thought, man, I have been working all my life for this. I am free. I got rid of all my responsibilities. The kids are gone, the wife's gone. I said, hell, I can drink in peace. You know, I really thought that. I thought I could really enjoy drinking, and I was already whipped by it. I'd been trying to quit drinking for 3 or 4 years before that. But I was, you know, telling these damn lies to myself. And 2 days after Thanksgiving in 1984, I remember calling up Primavera. I don't know where that number come from. It was up in my head. I never had went up out to see my wife. But one time I was drunk, and Dave from Little Washington, he happened to be the counselor up there, Dave D. And he said everybody up there had fallen in love with my wife, and she was up there. And then when I came up out of here one time, I was drunk. And I tell you something else, I hadn't shaved. I had a haircut for about 17 years. And I looked like something wild. And, you know, a drunk when he looks, you know. And I went up there drunk to see her, and they asked me to leave. And I said, I can't understand that. But anyway, That's the way I was thinking. But anyway, when I got in there, I called up there on a Friday night, the night after Thanksgiving, and I told the lady dancing, I said, I need some help drinking. She said, well, she asked me if it's good. She said, well, are you drinking now? I said, yeah. She said, well, wait till in the morning and call me. Well, you know what a drunk thing, you know. In the morning when I come to, I thought, you know, I almost screwed up. I don't need no help now. And, of course, I started drinking again. But anyway, it took me 3 nights of calling, and the last time I called on Sunday, she said, well, for God's sake, come on up there then. So my daughter came down there and got me, and I stopped down at Remington and got a six-pack, and I was going up the road. It wasn't but 7 miles over after the treatment, and I drank those six Budweisers and was crying up, oh, bum, that last beer I'll ever have and all that. You know how drunk he is. And I got up there to that place, and there was a couple nurses on there, and I really scared them to death. But like I say, I looked like something wild, and I was acting like somebody wild. And I don't know how long it been, but I had quit oral hygiene in my life. Had long since started, hadn't taken a bath, probably had 3 or 4 meals in my beard. And, you know, I didn't taper off taking a bath. I just quit. I didn't have time. It took too long to take a bath. Most people didn't know how long it takes to take a bath. I just didn't have time to do that. And, you know, days, they accumulate, first thing, no weeks, and you know, God knows when I've had bad, but, you know, they knew it, and I was in bad shape. I was in bad shape, and about the end of my drinking, I had been, like I say, trying to quit drinking. I knew what alcohol had done to me. I realized that my kids, I didn't have no idea they even had a drinking problem, 3 of them, until I got sober. And one of my youngest girl left home, quit 6 weeks before she graduated from high school, and left and ran off with somebody to get away from me. And I didn't know that till I got sober. But anyway, when I got sober and started going to meetings and realized what was going on, I hadn't been sober 3 or 4 months, and I went to work at Primavera at night shift, and had a girl up there named Lucille. She was in the program, and we worked together for a while. And she had bet me we couldn't quit smoking. She had quit that day, and I said, well, the next one that smokes a cigarette by the oven, a steak dinner, and we agreed, and she started smoking again before the night was over. So I quit smoking and almost drinking at the same time, which... I quit sex, too, all 3 of them same time. But I relapsed on one. I'll let y'all figure out which one that was. Anyway, they say time take care of everything. I believe it. But, you know, if you think you're having fun drinking, you're having fun. I had some good time drinking until it took a toll on me. I remember just before the end of my drinking and my wife, she was in pretty bad shape, and I was working in Orange, and she was down there in the kitchen. We had a lot of locusts around that old house down there on the river, and I had a storm that afternoon, and she was in there washing dishes, and one of the limbs fell off across it. I found out later. One of the limbs fell off across the fender of the window there, and she thought it was somebody trying to break in, because she was both dead mate shot, too. She kept 0.5 gallons of liquor all in the house. And it wouldn't give me a drink if I was dying. When I'd come home now, she'd hide that bit up, and I would have a truckload out there. And I'd come and sit and look at her. I said, you got a little taste? She said, no. I said, she said, have you? I said, no, sir. And we sat there until we get so damn miserable, we just have to get up and go get on, you know. And we had more than we could ever drink. But this evening, I got home, and she said, somebody tried to break in this window a while ago. I said, did? And I saw where the limit fell. So I was 2/3, and I got my rifle, went out there and loaded it, and I shot all up in the trees, up in the barn, you know. I was scared to death, didn't let anybody know it, but I was just shooting everywhere. And she hadn't told me she called the damn sheriff's department, and I hadn't asked her. So I had to be standing on my front porch, and of course, like I say, hair down to here, and the beard is bad, and looked like something wild, and a gun in my hand, and these lights with this swishing thing on the back come up the driveway, and somebody hollered out on the last speaker, hit the deck, drop that rifle or something. I said, what the hell's wrong with people? And they damn near shot me on my front porch. But finally, I let it go, and I walked out there, and they put me and said, they got my wife out there. Then went to the house and got her, and she was about two-thirds, and she got out there, and they said, is this a man you saw trying to break in? She said, I ain't never seen him before. So they slapped the handcuffs on me and put me in the back car and stomped me on down to 4th Street jail. And I heard the radio come on about halfway down, and somebody said, they said, bring him on back, and she's married to him. Little things like that. And the next day, I think it was the next day, I came out on the front porch, and I heard something out there, and I looked, and I saw the Bebco truck, and this guy was going up a pole, and I hollered at him. I said, wait a minute, what are you doing? He's going to cut the power off. I said, no, you're not. And I went back in the house, and I had my shotgun sitting right around the corner. I said, if you do, I'm going to blow you off that pole. So he came on back down. I said, I showed him. Then I stepped out. I said, yeah. But 10 minutes later, he came up the driveway, 4 or 5 of them switching antennas following him. And I didn't shoot him, and he cut that power off right quick. But he came over on the porch, and I said, I just paid that thing. He said, well, the last time you paid was 93 days. I said, seemed like yesterday to me. That's what everything felt like. Everything was yesterday. And I couldn't a bit more manage anything I was doing than a man in the moon. I mean, I just got into a hell of a shape. And anyway, when I got in treatment center up there, that old guy Dave told me, the first day I was up there, well, the first 3 days, they kept me back in the room by myself because I was in all kind of balls and BTs, and they finally got me out of there, and about a week later, they put me in a group therapy in a circle up in the second story up there, and had this guy named Humphrey. He was my counselor. He wasn't an alcoholic, but his daddy had died of alcoholism. Anyway, he thought he knew something about alcoholism, but he messed up one day. He went in that thing, and he trying to make me get honest with himself in front of all these people that I hated, and he made me mad, and I grabbed him, and I was going to throw him out the damn second store window. But it took 5 or 6 of them to stop me. But that's how crazy I was. I could have killed that man. I would have probably threw him out of that. But I couldn't stand the truth. You know, I just couldn't. But anyway, what happened to me the next night, the next 2 nights, I was in a room with, I think it was 4 of us in a room at that treatment center. And 3 of them had been there almost. The time was up, and they left the next day. And I was in that room by myself 3 or 4 days. And I know the first night I was in there by myself, I had some kind of spiritual experience or whatever you can call it. But I remember sitting on the side of my bed and crying like a baby most of the night. And the next morning when I got out and got to group or whatever, I felt a little different. And we were going to I was going to my first AA meeting that night. It was carrying us to Manassas. And I remember going down there, riding in the van and hating it. Oh, God, scared to death. But I got down there, and there was a fella down there that told my story. He was a color fella. He was 60 years old, and he just got out of penitentiary. But he told my story, except for really being locked up in a penitentiary. I was, same thing, I was a prisoner, but, you know, I could relate to him. And I remember coming back and calling my wife and telling her, getting all over. I said, you've been cleaned out of my nights. You're talking about my drinking. Why don't you talk about yours sometimes, you know? But I didn't have sense enough, no. He told my story. I didn't know people told your story in here. But that's how I started into AA. And coming back the road that night, I remember thinking, you know, God, maybe I could not drink. Maybe I could, you know. I was really excited. I really was. And I think they had lit my toilet there that night. I got that little skimp of flitter of hope or whatever, and I said, you know, just maybe that I cannot drink, you know. So it wasn't no time. It was the 24th of December, 1984, and I was getting out. 7 o'clock Christmas Eve, I got discharged. I didn't have no ride, nowhere to go. I knew the wife and kids, wasn't nobody down there, and the furniture and the lights had been cut off, but I said, well, I called my son. I said, I know he'll be drunk when he comes and gets me, and he was. And he took me down there and dropped me off at the lane. I walked over to the house that night and cold, wasn't no heat and nothing, you know. And I said, in a way, I can stay sober tonight. How in the hell am I going to stay sober? And I started feeling sorry for myself, but some way I made it through that night. Without drinking. Well, I guess it wasn't anything out of drinks, the only thing I know. It just must not have been nothing. If it did, I couldn't find it. And the next day, I don't know, around 1 or 2 o'clock, somebody came down the driveway and was, somebody had told a few people in town, some of the old timers, that I was down there. And Bill Johnson came down there and picked me up that day. And he took me back up to his house, and I stayed about 3 or 4 days. And my sister in Front Row had taken a collection. I didn't have no money, no place to go, no job. And she'd taken a collection and brought me about $900, I think. And I got caught up on a few bills and had the lights cut back on. And so I started, you know, in AA, my wife and I started going to meetings together. Plus, we went down to Remington. That's where we lived. And she was a, she knew the Baptist preacher down, and we went down and talked to him, and we started a little AA meeting down in Remington, out of towners group. And we had an old house that they let us use over there, and we stayed in that for about a year until a drunk went in there one night and burned it down. Thank God it wasn't none of us in the meeting, but the preacher said he knew the guy had been sleeping in there, you know, at night. But he went in that night and laid on the sofa and burned down, burned himself up too, but burnt the whole house down. So then they let us go in the church and have a room. But anyway, starting that meeting really got me started into AA, and I made coffee down there, I think, for about 12 years, and just made it, set the meeting up, and I think I missed 2 wins, but it kept me sober. It's got me, that wasn't, I was going to a meeting every night some, and during the day, and I got to run around with Bill J. and Johnny Marsh for about 5 years. I got to be his partner. He took me under his wing for some reason, that old man did. And I got to loving him like I did a father. I never had a father like a love, and I really didn't know what the word meant, love. And I didn't learn it till years in his program. And I don't know if I really know, but I'm beginning to learn what it is, what it means. But them old timers come and got me and made me a part of their life. And I could not understand for life me what in the world I had they wanted. And old Johnny used to come and get me. If I didn't call, he'd call. If I didn't answer the phone, he didn't live but 2 blocks when I moved back in town. He'd come around there in the car. He said, I got a leak in my kitchen faucet. He'd take me around. There wasn't no leak. He just wanted to talk. Call every day. He wouldn't give me a chance to take a drink. Smothered me. That's what it took. Him and I got to running around. I carried him everywhere, and him and Bill J. and I got to running. I stayed with Bill. I remember the first thing I heard Bill Johnson say in an AA meeting. He said, I've been in AA 10 years now. He said, I've never worked since I've been in here. And I heard that. I ain't hear nothing else that day, but I heard that. I said, he can do it, I can do it. But anyway, for the next 10 years, I swear, and of course I've been hurt on the job and getting a little bit of money from workers' comp. But for the next 10 years, Bill Johnson and I and Doug Phillips rode to meetings all over the country. We go to races, either day or night, go back to meetings or vice versa. And for 10 years, I had more money, more sense, more everything than I ever thought possible. And never worked. But I didn't drink. And that's what they told me. Them old timers told me, said, if you don't drink, bummy, and you go to meetings, you can have everything you need. I said, that's stupid. Man, I got some needs now. I need things now. But anyway, I got to getting sober in here, and I got to thinking about my kids. And my oldest son had gotten married and had a child. And I helped him build a new house. And we did the warm plumbing, built the house and all. And he was really into booze, Dad. And he reminded me of every time I look at him, I could see me. So we didn't get along. And I had a lot of guilt because I used to take him with me when I worked. Ever since he was big enough to walk, he would go with me and start drinking. I'd let him have beer and all. So I had a hell of a lot of guilt, because I thought it was my fault. He got divorced, and they took his kid and everything away from him. He did a few things he wasn't supposed to, and he got caught, and he had to spend a year in the Rappahannock jail. And after he got out, he went to a halfway house in Winchester, and he's never drinking. He's got 21 years, but he don't go to meetings. But anyway, before that, I was thinking, if I could just help him, you know. One night, we were all together, my kids, a few of us, and the phone rang, was Roger. He'd been sleeping down underneath the Mountain Run Bridge down about 3 weeks in a cardboard box. And he called me one night, and he said, Daddy, he said, can you help me? And I said, what do you need help with? He said, I need help for drinking. And I said, no, I can't help you, but I'll come and get you, and I'll take you somewhere that they can help you. Because I want to jump in there and choke his ass. Can't you see what you're doing, boy? You know, no, indeed, could I see? So I took him to a Stanton over there, and he got into Boxwood in about 3 or 4 weeks or whatever it took, but he stayed over Stanton, dried out, and he got into Boxwood and didn't have a drink. About a year after that, my youngest daughter, April, she had been in two marriages, and just couldn't, you know, everything went wrong. So she'd been running. That's how you do. You run from this damn disease. She'd been running, and she had moved to North Carolina, down there in the mountains of Boone, North Carolina. And 12 o'clock one night, I got a phone call from her, and she said, "Daddy," I said, "can you come get me? I need help." I said, "What do you need help for?" She said, "My drinking." I said, "Yes." I got up out of bed. It was 12:30 at night, and I said, "You got anything to drink?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, don't quit. You'll die." I said, "I'll bring you six for the trip back, but don't quit drinking. Just keep enough on you to." And we left that night. My wife and I went down to North Carolina and got her, and come back up the road, and she said, "I don't want to go anywhere but home with you and Daddy to get sober." But she went in. We put her in a place called Pine Brook and Cup, and she got, you know, in a treatment, and she came and lived with us for 6 to 8 months after that and got sober, and she hadn't had a drink. She's got 18 or 19 years. Well, then, that was my youngest boy. He was the worst one of us, I believe. He had got so he was drinking a fifth or two of vodka a day and locked himself in the apartment there where he lived, and just, he was gay. I never would have accepted that drunk. Never. And I kind of figured it out, but I never would have accepted that. And this program, you know, really has opened my eyes, boy. But anyway, when he died this past May, he was diagnosed with lung cancer, and they told me he had 8 to 11 months, and he lived 9 months, but we really got close. And even his partner, I just thought the world of him, just like being a wife. I accepted that, what he was. He didn't ask to be that. I didn't ask to be an alcoholic. But you got to take the card that had dealt you. But anyway, he was really in bad shape, and he called me one night. He called me, all three of my kids called me. They did, and I couldn't, you know, that just makes chills go up me now. He said the same thing. He said, "Daddy, can you come get me and help me?" I said, "No, I can't help you, but I'll take you somewhere they can." And all three of them, I went and got, and I took them to a treatment center, and they all got sober. And God allowed me to do that, you know, this program. And that, I tell you, it's quite an experience. Anyway, I've been through, you know, a lot of deaths. I had my mother to die when I was 7 years sober. I never made amends to her. And you talking about a cussing I gave God that night. How dare you take my mother and leave my sorry-ass daddy here? I just cuss God every now and then. I'm just playing God. I'm 7 years sober, just crazy. I'm not, you know, just like a drunk. I was living like a drunk and trying to be sober. That's what I was thinking, like a drunk. And Bill Johnson got me straightened up for that. He, you know, if it hadn't been for them old timers, I would have been dead or drunk. And they told me, they say it in so simple words I could understand it. But hadn't been for the, you know, I don't know. But anyway, when I got into AA and started realizing the harm I had done people and all the wreckage and all in the past, and how in the world do you make up for stuff like that, I said. And old John said, "Well, you can't change anything that you've already done." He said, "The only thing you can do is not drink today and get to the meeting." He said, "And try not to do it again." He said, "God will forgive you, but you can't keep on going back and doing the same thing expecting God to forgive you." And when I got here, I'm scared death of this thing called God. I tell you, I'm sure I believe maybe that was a God. I guess everybody's born with that instinct in them, but I was scared that my mother had told me about God, and every time I'd do something bad, she'd lock me in the closet. And she'd say, "God's going to get you for that." Well, I was scared death of whatever God it was. And I said, "Yeah, it's a God, but he's for them people over in Oakland that's got the Cadillacs and the damn boats. He ain't done nothing for me." And that's what I thought. And I said, "Well, he'd been keeping score on me." When I got to AA and I found out about a God, I said, "Man, I'm going to pay dearly for what I've done. I know that." So I was scared. I got so I refused to think about a higher power for a couple of years. I mean, I just couldn't do it. I was scared. And Johnny told me one day, he said, "Bummy," he said, "AA and ain't trying to tell you nothing about, it's not, what's not important." He said, "It's not important if there's a God or whether there isn't a God. That's not important." He said, "What's important is whether you believe it is or not." And he would tell me these little things about, you know, and I would, light bulb would come on. I know in 85, a year after I got sober, I had a wreck on the job. And I was driving another fella down behind in Lignum, Virginia. And the boy, the driving boat killed me two or three times. As a rule, I didn't ride with him on. I told the manager, I said, I'm not riding with two boy anymore. He said, he's trying to kill me. He's too damn, he drives too fast. And this Monday morning, I got in with him. We wasn't going but 2 miles, and he run me into a cedar tree down on Calico Mills Road. And the truck we was in run on propane gas, and he hit a cedar tree right on my side and put the motor right back in my lap. But in 1970, I was in a bad accident and broke everything I had. In 1970, I was 30 years old, 28, somewhere like that, but it broke. And I stayed up at university 197 days, and when I got out of that, they had me in a body cast for a year and a half. I couldn't wiggle nothing but my toes and my fingers and my nose. And I went back up there and stayed up there 6 weeks when they took that cast off and the meat and all come off with it, leaving nothing but the bones on me. And they put me in a whirlpool up there for 4 weeks. But it took me a long time. I got over that, and 4 years later, I was over my sister's one day, and smart aleck drinking, still on crutches, well, had a cane, and my nieces were riding down a hill on a wheel, and I said, let me show y'all how to ride that thing. And I got on there, and as soon as I started down, both my legs caught behind it, and sounded like a shotgun going off, and broke them both again. But anyway, so that's twice up until this day that I had both my legs broke, and then in 1985 when I had that wreck, it broke them all again. But when I looked down that day, I'll never forget, I could see both the bones coming out, and both my feet were turned backwards, so I knew they were broke. And Tubu, the guy driving, he was about 75 years old then, and it kind of dazed him, and I was hitting at him. I said, the truck was on fire, and I said, get the fire extinguisher. I couldn't move. That thing had me pinned. And he just was out of it. He was, you know, looked like he just in a daze. So I was trying to get my knife out of my pocket. What I had planned on doing was cutting the meat off my leg so I could get out of that. I was just going to, because the bones were already broke. But I was trying to get my knife out. And a state trooper was going over to Inlet to where the state police office was that morning. He never had been through this dirt road, and he looked on the map and said, that's a shortcut. He came through that. He got that just about the time this happened. Got out his car, got the fire extinguisher out, put the fire out. But in the meantime, before he got there, I got on the two-way radio and called Carolyn, which was a girl at the office, and I said, send the ambulance and fire truck down here. And then it went dead. Well, when they got there, it took them about 3 hours to cut me out of it. And somebody would ask me in the rescue squad how I called the office. I said, I called it on a two-way radio. He said, that's impossible. He said, the first thing he hit was that battery and just busted that in 10 billion feet. He said, it's impossible. He said, there's no way that radio could have worked. I said, it worked. It wasn't humanly impossible, but it worked for a second until I told them people. They sent the ambulance down there. And I got to think about that. And then a few months later, I was supposed to have some more surgery. I think I had surgery 8 or 10 times from that. And I was going to have surgery one night. And I went out to the hospital, and 11 o'clock at night, they shaved and all, and the nurse came in at night and said, what kind of medication do you take? And I told her, and she went and got them, and she brought back a cup about that big with a bunch of pills. And I said, my God, I don't take all in. She said you take Minipress. I said, yeah, I think it's about 50 milligrams. She said, well, that's a new type, so take them. Well, I took them, and I went my own sleep, knocked me right on out. And the next morning, I had a guy over there named Dr. Hale. I bet you knew him. He was a pharmacist there. He went to work there when he did now. Well, he saved my life that night. Something woke that man up at 3 o'clock in the morning. And he told me this later. Told my daughter first, then he told me. Something woke him up. Never had before. Said, get to the hospital. He didn't know why. He got out of bed, got dressed, and went to the hospital. Didn't know why he was even going out there. He went to his office, sat down at his desk, and happened to look at a piece of paper on top of his desk, and he got it and looked at it, and he said, Bumgarner, somebody gave, who in the world gave him 50 milligrams of Minipress? See, they took all the paperwork and put it on his desk when they give medication. So he called upstairs right immediately, And they were going to take me down to surgery at 5 o'clock in the morning. And he said, don't take him nowhere. He said, somebody get him and take him. Said, he's been overdosed. And said, if you put him to sleep or try to knock him out, he'll never wake up. I got to think about that. And what woke that man up? What did he, you know, little things like that, you know, and wasn't coincidences. And I got to think, you know, must be a God. Got to be. I've had a lot of things like that happen. And they ain't coincidence to me. They've been real. But I have to be shown. I'm born in Virginia, but I'm from Missouri. You got to show me. Well, they ain't showing me. But I am so grateful that I got in here and I had the people around me that knew how to handle me and treat me because, you know, when I come in here, one-hour meeting would not have fixed me. And them old-timers would get me, come by. John would come by my house at 8 o'clock in the morning, blow the horn. I'd go out, where are we going? He said, get in. And we'd ride. We'd just ride. He'd bring me back 10 o'clock at night after a meeting. We'd go all over the country. About 5 years they did that. Bill Johnson and I happened to be out to the hospital the night that old Johnny died. We were out there, and we watched him take his last breath. And we got up and said the Lord's Prayer, holding his hand, and I got to be there with Bill Johnson myself, and that I'll never forget that. That was a, you know, that's something that it just don't happen. And for my wife, in 1996, she got so sick. She was 12 years sober, and she had some bad problems. And of course, I didn't know it. I knew it then, but she had a bad liver. She went in the hospital, and we had just bought a new house. She up to Madison and 10 acres, and we were just so happy, and she lived up there one night, and the next morning I had to take her to the hospital, and she never did live to come out of there. And she died on it, July the 6th, and myself and my four kids were out there and in the bed when she took her last breath, and this fellowship allowed us to grab her hand and say the Lord's Prayer with her while she died. And when I came out of there, Bill Johnson was standing up for me to cry on his shoulder. I didn't want to, but I did. I don't remember crying before that or after. I don't remember the last time I cried, but, you know, things like that. And then, you know, I've had a lot of deaths in my family. But the greatest thing that I really had needed help with was when my son died this past May, my youngest son. And the day that we went to Farmville, and he called us, and we went down there, and he was at the hospital inn, and they showed us his x-rays, and the doctor came in and said, told him that it's lung cancer, and said, he said, I'm going to be truthful with y'all. He said, it's fatal. He's got that small cell type, and he said, we probably guessing 8 to 11 months. So Robert said, well, I want to come back up. I want to come home if I'm going to die. So we came back up in. We found a place at Madison and April, and she wanted to take care of him. But anyway, April took care of him for until he died, and I was up there every day, most of the day with him. And hadn't been for this program, I couldn't have done that. I'd have been dead or drunk. I couldn't have stood. I'd have been pulled me this and pulled me that. But the fellowship has really, really gave me a way of life that I had no idea existed. So I lived by myself since my wife died 15 years. Kids been in and out, but mostly by myself. And April just moved in with me about 2 months ago, and my youngest daughter. I told somebody, I can't find a damn thing now. She's done the head thing. But I love her. I love her, you know, and I got three grandkids. And it's just a great family. We're a close family. I got a couple things I want to read for you. One of them is pretty sad. You might want to get your hanks about. But I've had this since I've been in AA. I like to read it every now and then. It's a woman got a letter from a son in the penitentiary, and he wrote a letter, and I guess he was in there for some kind of drug-related stuff, but said, pretty sad. It starts out like this. Dear son, I'm writing this letter slow because I know you can't read very fast. We don't live where we did when you were home. Said your pa read that most accidents happen within 25 miles of the house, so we moved. Don't know what our address is now. Said the people that lived here before took the numbers with them, so we don't have no address. Said this place got a new wash machine in it. Said I put two of your pa's shirts in it the other day and pulled a chain. I ain't seen them since. Said about your that new coat you wanted your aunt to send you. Said we got those. Said it had them big brass buckles on it. So we couldn't mail them with them heavy buttons on it. So we cut them off and put them in the pockets and mail them to you. And said it hadn't rained but twice this week here, 4 days the first and 3 days the second. Said about your Uncle John, said he's got a new job. He's got 500 people working under him. He's cutting grass at the new cemetery. Said, about your sister Sarah, said she had a baby the other day. We don't know whether it's a boy or a girl yet, so I don't know if you're an aunt or uncle. Said, we got a bill from the funeral home the other day about your grandma. Said, didn't make a payment on her. Up she comes. About your old buddy. Said, three old buddies run off the old wooden bridge down the other night. Said, the one driving, Tom, said, got out. But said, the two in the back ran. They couldn't get the tailgate down. Said, you remember about your old Uncle Sid that worked down at the distillery, don't you? Said, well, he fell in the whiskey vat down there the other day and drowned. Four people jumped in to save him, but he fought them off and drowned anyway. Said, we had him cremated and he burnt for 3 days. Said, nothing much happened. Said, hope you can come home soon. P.S. I was going to put some money in the letter, but I'd already sealed it. Anyway, that's that. And this thing here is a new preamble we're going to have out here if y'all don't look out. But this comes from Blackstone. And this, somebody wrote this anonymous, but it's pretty nice. I like it. Said, Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship designed and administered by a bunch of ex-drunks whose only qualification for membership is that they can't hold a liquor and they don't want to learn how. It has no rules, dues, or fees, nor anything else that any sensible organization seems to require. At meetings, the speaker starts on one subject and winds up talking about something entirely different, and concludes by saying he doesn't know anything about the program except that it works. The groups are always broke, yet always seem to have money to carry on. They're always losing members, but seem to grow. They claim AA is a selfish program, but always seem to be doing something for others. Every group passes laws, rules, edits, and pronouncements, which everyone bitterly ignores. Members who disagree with everything are privileged to walk out in a huff, quitting forever, only to return as though nothing ever happened and greeting accordingly. Nothing is ever planned 24 hours ahead, yet great projects are born and survive magnificently. Nothing in AA is according to whole. How can it survive? Perhaps it's because we have learned to live and laugh at ourselves. God made man. He also made laughter. Perhaps he is pleased with our disorganized groups and makes things right, no matter who pushes the wrong button. Maybe he is pleased not with our profession, but with our sincerity. Maybe he is pleased with our try to be nobody but ourselves. We don't know how it works, but we know it does. If members keep receiving their dividend checks from their AA investments, it is smart to be sober. It is much easier, my friend, to say sober than to get sober. And that said that was stolen. Nobody knows who wrote that. But anyway, some of my old timers told me time and time again in AA, said, Bummer, you don't know a damn thing about giving an AA talk. But I tell you one thing I do know how to do. I know how to end one.